Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin, and today on the pod, we had a great conversation with Charlotte Clymer, who is the press secretary for Rapid Response for the Human Rights Campaign, and also the coolest person I follow on Twitter. So Varsha and I had a great conversation, and we kind of all joked that it was audio brunch because we did it on a Saturday morning. And without any further ado, I'm just going to get straight to the conversation because it is wonderful. So please enjoy this very special episode where we discuss the dumpster fire that is the Commonwealth of Virginia, 2020 candidates, and policy and politics in the age of Twitter. Varsha and I are here with Charlotte Clymer, who is the press secretary of Rapid Response for the Human Rights Campaign, and also the best person you could possibly follow on Twitter. So, Charlotte, thank you for sitting down with us. It's also a Saturday morning, which is just going above and beyond the call of being a good Twitter friend.
I look at this as an audio brunch, personally.
Yeah. Oh, an audio brunch.
That's great.
Can we brand that?
I get the chill with people who are really fucking badass, and that makes me happy.
Thank you. Thank you. And it is, especially because I think you're super badass. So being you saying that to me made my whole day. I love this idea of audio brunch. We're just kind of going to talk about the bullshit that's going on. I want to start with a story that's sort of out of the news cycle now because we live in hell and the news cycle is just constantly changing, which is the dumpster fire that is the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Yeah. And it seems no one wants to resign. And it's like, why? Why is no one resigning?
That was sort of my question. Like, what is it going to take? Are they actually going to get their butts out of there, or are they going to try to ride this out?
It's so complicated right now. It really is.
Yeah, I feel like Northam is just like riding the storm. Like he announced a bunch of pardons and basically like giving back voting rights to a bunch of former felons before the scandal broke out. And then after the scandal broke out, he made a big show of like doing it again, but he would already had announced this. This wasn't something that was like brand new. He was basically like, this is how I'm going to get African-American cred back. And I'm like, no, this is horrible. It's a horrible thing to do. And then Justin Fairfax has two accusations against him, two accusations of rape. This is like intense. And then Mark Herring, poor guy. I mean, like, I don't feel bad for him because, again, he did put on blackface at age 19. But at the very least, he came forward with it and like truly felt some remorse and gave a public as well as a private apology to the legislators in Virginia. So it's a really bad dumpster fire.
Well, and here the situation is complicated because he also called for Northam to resign before he came out publicly about his own blackface incident. Which, so everyone is like, everyone's basically taken cyanide pills in this situation.
Yes!
Right?
Yeah. Right!
Because here's the thing, because Northam can't let Fairfax resign, because if Fairfax resigns, it's going to look really bad if the black lieutenant governor resigns and Northam doesn't.
Yeah.
Over his own shit. Even though Fairfax absolutely should resign because I believe both those women.
All the way around. And you just, it's really difficult. And what the other thing that is really bothering me about this story is that people are trying to frame this as like whataboutism.
Yeah.
Like, oh, well, Trump's in the White House and these are good Democratic men who are leading this state and all this nonsense. And I'm like, this can be more than one thing. This can be absolutely shitty and completely unacceptable. And also Trump can be also shitty and unacceptable. And I hate this whataboutism that comes up, especially when it comes to, you know, men being shitty.
Yeah, especially in the Fairfax situation. This idea that because Kavanaugh is on the court and because Clarence Thomas is on the court, we have to give Justin Fairfax a pass. And I'm like, no, we definitely do not. I feel like out of the three situations, the most egregious is the Fairfax one. And I understand that it's difficult that it's the most egregious one because he is the only African-American statewide official right now in Virginia. And I get it. That really, really sucks. But these women are really fucking credible. Like, it's really clear that he did this shit. And I hate that I have to say allegedly, but yeah, it's really clear that he did this shit. So it's, he really, I saw on Twitter, and I saw like a bunch of explainers on this. And like the most reasonable way for this to go is for Fairfax to resign first, for Northam to appoint another LG, and then for Northam to resign. And then there's like a special election or something. And that's like the most reasonable way this could go, because at this point, it's really hard for me to see why Herring has to resign. I feel like if he has to resign, it should be a decision of the Congressional Black Caucus in Virginia and the other legislators in Virginia. But Northam and Fairfax have to fucking go. They gotta go. It's bad.
They really do. I mean, and it's really frustrating to hear people do that whataboutism that you were discussing. It pisses me off when some Democrats will have very strong values when Republicans are fucking up. Right, but then when we're fucking up, they're like, well, you know, it's a different situation. It's like, no, it's really not. It's like with Franken. You know, I really like Al Franken. I just think he was inappropriate on numerous occasions. And he should have resigned. And it's good that Gillibrand had him resign. Or not had him resign, but you know, came out along with, you know, a ton of other senators and telling him he should resign. I really think that it bothers me that in terms of social politics or identity politics, the only thing people should be thinking when they look at this whole situation is, God damn, we really do need more women of color in government.
Yeah.
Yes. You know? Okay, so that's the thing. Well, and so for me, I the reason why I keep bringing up this particular dumpster fire is because I feel like it's really indicative of a lot of the approach to politics. And when it comes right down to it, like you said, Charlotte, you know, Democrats are really good about being sanctimonious when it's Republicans, and then have a much more difficult time when it's Democrats. And it really comes down to this, like, you know, really culture of white supremacy and men protecting men. And we need to, really the only way to solve this is to elect women of color. I mean, that's it. That's the entire way to solve this. Like,
and it makes sense because women of color, I promise I'm not trying to pander here. It's just true. Women of color are the backbone of the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
Hands down.
Well,
like, it's right. Not even a point that's up for debate.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, and so actually this brings us kind of to the next thing I want to talk about, which is the already bananas slate of 2020 Democratic candidates for president. Because what has been really bothering me, basically this whole episode is just going to be me telling you what irritates me, so you're welcome. but what's really pissing me off is when people are saying, oh, the Democratic Party needs to run someone who can win against Trump, not who is the best candidate, which is basically what they're implying. And I'm like, no. You're asking if this person can win against Trump is asking the wrong question. The right question is, we need to start representing the base of the Democratic Party, which is not old white dudes. It's not. It is women of color and women and people of color. And the sooner you get on that fucking train, the faster we're going to get Trump out of office.
And I got to say, like, I don't know who I'm supporting yet. I have no idea. But I really think this, you know, low-key strategy of some of the candidates in the party wanting to appeal to middle class, middle America, white folks is a really, really bad way to approach this election.
It's a really dumb strategy, because the thing is where Hillary Clinton overperformed and did really well was not those people. And you just need you literally have to, like, instead of looking at the 2016 election as if it was a giant indictment on everything that the Democratic Party stands for, look at 2016 as a fluke, specifically in three states. And then if you want to, like, really expand the map, look at it as a fluke in a few other states and be like, how do you expand the voters in those states? And in those states, who you focus on is working class people of all ethnicities, and you focus on people of color, like, regardless of their class. You don't go and go, how do we reclaim voters who haven't voted for us in years? Like, how are we going to get Ohio back? We're really not. It's going to be really, really tough. And so instead of going, oh, if we nominate Sherrod Brown, we're definitely going to get Ohio. Instead of thinking like that, think of who is, like, getting really, really big crowds right now? Who is getting a lot of support? Who, maybe, it's a wild idea, who is putting forward policy ideas that I really like? I mean, I don't know. I vote for people based on policy ideas. It's a wild thing. It seems a little crazy. But it's so frustrating to see people of, like, everyone, like, not even, like, people who, like, have never watched cable news play armchair pundit with the 2020 election. And I'm like, don't. You know what? Just go on their websites and figure out who you support. I'm sure by the time the debates come around, a bunch of people will have dropped off and you will have, like, five or six candidates that really, really say something about who they are in terms of policy. And support those people. Don't try to play armchair pundit. It's not going to work.
Amen to that. And I think it's really unfortunate the way that folks are still dividing this into we either have to do a broad economic piece or mm-hmm. we have to focus on social identity. That's complete bullshit. We can do both. We can do both those things.
It's a false choice. Right. It exactly is. Between the two. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like that's what I like about a bunch of the new Democrats, female Democrats that were elected to the House, right? So when you think of Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, as well as like others like Charisse Davids, all of them have been putting forward really bold and amazing economic ideas and ways to really help people when it comes to their paychecks, when it comes to helping poor people, when it comes to helping the working poor. But they also don't like avoid the fact that there is institutional and structural racism and sexism in this country. They don't like avoid the fact that there is a trans military ban or a Muslim ban or all these other horrible things. They say this is like we are literally a big tent.
Right. And the other thing too is that there's this persistent idea, especially with a lot of white Democrats who believe that by downplaying LGBTQ stuff, women's issues, systemic racism, things like that, that by doing that and amplifying broad issues of, you know, economic policy, that will somehow attract, you know, more moderates or peel off away Trump voters. And let me tell you how much of a mistake that is. These folks do not give a shit about us pandering to them. They don't care. They really don't care that the people who are going to vote for Trump are going to vote for Trump because he validates their hatred. That's why they're voting for Trump, not because he promises this pie in the sky bullshit. It's because he says you deserve economic revitalization, but people of color don't. You know, you deserve all this, you know, policy that helps you day to day, but queer people don't. And, you know, certainly women don't deserve, you know, equal pay, et cetera, et cetera. He basically erases all of their social anxieties and tells them that it's completely fine to fear a new world in which, you know, white men are no longer the center of attention. That's why they vote for him. That's it. And so many pundits find this so hard to accept. They can't get on board with the idea that there are folks out there who are that completely hateful and cynical. But it's true.
Right. Well, I always think about the New York Times article about the shutdown and how it was affecting people in Florida. And the last line of it was this quote from a woman who went on the record with her real name and said, Trump is hurting the wrong people. Yeah. Like she was disappointed in the shutdown because it was hurting the wrong people. And I was like, oh, girl, you didn't even like use a fake name or go on background. Like you, like that is such a pervasive understanding of what Trump is supposed to be doing.
Yeah. And did the reporter push back on that and ask?
No, it was just the end quote.
No,
yeah.
Fucking course not.
Right. Right. And it just blows my mind because what I always like to say about that, I'm like, no, he's hurting exactly the people he's supposed to be hurting, which is everyone who is not a very rich white man. Like that's always been the game.
Yeah, and let's say something. I want Harley Davidson to fail. I do. I want them to fail as business. And it's not because I want the folks who work for them to be hurt. It's because we need to get behind this idea that corporations should not be pandered to like fucking children.
Yeah.
Right.
Especially right. when they completely sell out the American people and ship jobs overseas.
It doesn't make sense. Yeah. It's it was always true to people who weren't rich white people that Donald Trump wasn't working for them, or at least specifically like people of color. Like, we always knew, but it really, I think it comes as a shock to some people who are Trump voters who are just like, oh, yeah, this trade deal actually sucks for me. But then they still, because of what you said, because they still are so hateful, they will still continue to vote for Trump.
Right.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's really kind of amazing. Like the 1984 levels of doublethink that these people are doing. But it also, like, really, you know, when we talk about 2016 and as we talk about moving into 2020, you know, the one thing that people keep saying about Hillary Clinton is that she skipped Wisconsin or Michigan or whatever bullshit state they're saying that she skipped, regardless of the fact that she won the popular vote by 3 million votes. And so this sort of idea that they're like criticizing the campaign and criticizing, you know, a campaign that won the popular vote. And it feels like these sort of purity tests that are coming out on these 2020 candidates. Like, you, Charlotte, I don't know exactly who I am supporting yet, but I do know that there's already this sort of viciousness in how we are dissecting these candidates and their strategies and their records. And if you don't agree with me on every single thing ever, I could never vote for you. And I think that's just going to really be it's going to backfire in 2020.
I do too. And, you know, by the way, the other thing about the Hillary Clinton, her performance in 2016 that people always miss, she got more votes than any presidential candidate in history except for Barack Obama. Right. She got almost as many votes as Obama did in 2012. And people always ignore that or they forget it. It wasn't just that she beat Trump by 3 million votes. It's that she performed remarkably well for any candidate ever in a presidential election. Mm-hmm. And I also think that even if she had won, even if, you know, Russia had not colluded, if Comey hadn't released the that news like
October surprise,
if all that shit hadn't happened and she had won, she would still be criticized.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If she had won by like 6 million votes and, you know, won all three of those states, they'd be like, well, I can't believe that she did this poorly in her victory against Trump.
Right.
She would have lost a mandate. Right. As far as the purity stuff, I find it remarkably interesting how their issues are completely sacrosanct, but the issues that matter to us, you know, people who are queer, women, people of color, are somehow negotiable.
Yeah.
I had this person respond to me on Twitter not too long ago, and it was a very banal tweet. I more just said that, you know, it wasn't directed at anyone. I just said that, you know, if you're looking for a presidential candidate who's perfect, let me know if you find them. And that was it. And I just wanted people to, you know, kind of chew on that as food for thought. This person responded to me, well, these are the five issues that I will not negotiate on. And this person listed five economic issues. And so I responded, well, what about women's rights and, you know, LGBTQ rights and systemic racism? And they're like, well, that's always a given. I'm like, well, it's not, though.
It isn't. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. There's something that you always forgo something when you focus on one or the other or one type of policy or the other. And I feel like the best thing about so many of the 2020 candidates is that they're not doing that. When you look at Kirsten Gillibrand or Kamala Harris or Elizabeth Warren, notice how I'm only listing the women, they're really trying to like tie in the fact that there is systemic inequality when it comes to race and gender and sexual orientation in this country, as well as a systemic inequality when it comes to the economy. And they are really trying to tie those two together in a way that it was hard for Hillary Clinton to do because she was always responding to the bullshit that Trump was throwing. And I feel like, and she was always responding the way that a lot of Bernie Sanders voters wanted her to respond, because she did spend a lot of fucking time talking about the economy. She talked about the economy more than Donald Trump did, right? But exactly. And so
not to knock on my girl, but like, I talk about the economy more than
it was
Trump
more
did.
That like in right now with these candidates, people are choosing one candidate, like such as Kamala Harris, being like, oh, what is her criminal justice record? Because she is the only prosecutor in the race so far. So now we need to really, really focus in on her criminal justice record. And because she doesn't fit with my record, I am not going to vote for her. Kirsten Gillibrand, she lives in New York. She must love banks. Elizabeth Warren. Elizabeth Warren used to.
I love that's the whole sentence.
That's literally in New York. What they say to me on Twitter. It's so annoying. I'm like, wait. She literally gave a full-throated defense for Medicare for All and single payer like a couple days ago, and all you're talking about is how she lives in New York and she must love banks. Like, I'm like, what the fuck do you want from these people? I don't know. And so that's what really bothers me, is that they're not even waiting just a couple of months for their policy ideas to go on the website or for the debates or anything. They're just like, I am going to make my decision right now, because right now I really am split. Like, I can even see myself like voting for a man. Like, Julian Castro looks pretty cool. I'm not going to lie, right? So it's really hard to choose right now. So this idea that people out there have already made their decision is a little BS. You can't have made your decision yet.
And it pisses me off how fast their certainly more solid positions fly out the window when they become inconvenient. Mm. So like, for example, for about a solid week, Barbara Lee was talked about as being a worthy challenger to Nancy Pelosi for the speakership. Mm-hmm. And there was this huge push on Twitter to get Barbara Lee nominated. Now, look, I love Barbara Lee. I think she's fantastic. I didn't think this was the right time for her speaker. I thought Nancy Pelosi should just stay on in terms of continuity and just keeping the party together. But, you know, obviously Barbara Lee didn't, you know, go out for speaker. She endorsed Nancy Pelosi, et cetera, et cetera. So fast forward to, you know, this week, Barbara Lee comes out and endorses Kamala Harris for president. And within minutes, you had all these Bernie supporters going online and saying Barbara Lee is quote unquote canceled.
You cannot cancel my congresswoman. Oh. My congresswoman is the only congresswoman to vote against the Iraq war. She has been a badass since before you were fucking born, okay? It was like, what the I was watching this too. And then just yesterday, Dolores Huerta, who's a labor leader, along with like Cesar Chavez, nominated or endorsed Kamala Harris as well. And I was like, I tweeted on Twitter, I can't wait until Dolores Huerta is canceled by these Bernie bros. Like, Dolores Huerta, like, seriously.
Like, Dolores Huerta gives a shit about these people.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, that is really the beauty of this, where Barbara Lee is probably like, ooh, I'm canceled by the young millennials.
But that's
excellent.
But that's exactly what you mean by like this sexism, is this idea that, oh, as soon as, instead of thinking, oh, these two progressive women are endorsing Kamala Harris, I should think, huh, maybe Kamala Harris is progressive, or maybe I should rethink my ideas about her or look deeper into what she's proposing as president. No. It's Barbara Lee and Dolores Huerta who are the real shills here, not me. Like, what the hell?
Everything must be a conspiracy, right? So immediately it was like, oh, well, Barbara Lee lives in the same area as Kamala Harris, so that must be why she's voting there.
Yeah, it was geography.
Or she's a black woman, so she must have to support her because she's a black woman. That could be the only reason why. You know, it can't be that Barbara Lee is just independently looking at this election and thinking, look, Kamala Harris is probably the best person to, you know, put us forward. And I'm not sure I agree with that yet. You know, like, I have to wait to see all the other candidates and see what everyone proposes. Mm-hmm. But I respect Barbara Lee enough to be like, well, you know what? She probably had a damn good reason for it.
Yeah.
And so I think I should respect her take.
Well, and I think what this really comes down to is that, you know, women of color, women and people of color aren't allowed to tease out those identities, and on more intersections as well, on LGBTQ status, on class, on ethnicity, on the language you speak. You're not really allowed to tease out those identities from your political beliefs or your policy mm-hmm. ideas, and that they have to be, that they're all packaged together, and it comes down to, oh, well, they're both black women, or oh, they both are from that liberal ass California, you know, that they're not, whereas like white men are basically given the ability to separate themselves from their policy a little bit in terms of their personal, like their personal beliefs and their political beliefs, and women, people of color, and, you know, it just, they're not given that same
ability.
No, Oh, no, I was just going to say, and so what it ends up being is, like, it's almost, it goes back to this, like, you know, with Hillary Clinton, it's like, I just don't like her. I'm like, bitch, you're not inviting her over for dinner. Like, I don't care if you like her. Like, you know, but there's this idea that women have to be all of your political ideals and your ideal person because they're not allowed to separate.
Yeah. I mean, so the recent Kirsten Gillibrand kerfuffle was the way she eats fried chicken. And I swear to God, as a vegetarian and as a person who, like, who loves eating, I couldn't give a shit. Like, I couldn't give less of a shit. It was so annoying to be like, oh, she's so opportunistic and she's clearly, like, never eaten chicken before. I'm like, who the fuck cares if she's ever eaten chicken before? I don't care. And then yesterday, Kamala Harris was eating barbecue in Texas. She had a bottle of hot sauce and somebody put a picture of her putting hot sauce on her barbecue and everyone lost their shit. They were like, oh, she's not really somebody who eats hot sauce. I bet she never eats hot sauce. I'm like, how the fuck do you know? Also, why do you care if she eats hot sauce? I don't understand. And it really goes down to the fucking sexism. It's sexism all the way down. Like, it's so bad.
And I don't know if you saw this, but it wasn't like some random person in a diner who took a picture of Kirsten Gillibrand eating chicken that way. It was Jonathan Martin at the New York Times, who's covering all this. I don't have anything specifically against Jonathan Martin, but here's a reporter who uses his platform and focuses on something so trivial and makes it an issue. I don't think much of the media has learned the lessons of 2016 yet. Nope. I know. Especially the men.
Yeah, especially the men. Yeah. Because, like, for some reason...
It's like, wait, we did this. Did we not do this?
Like, for some reason, people are still... Okay, when it comes to Elizabeth Warren and the Native American DNA test, right? I'm listening to Native American people on my Twitter who are telling me this is still bad. This is still unacceptable because she hasn't given a public apology. She apologized to the Cherokee Nation and they accepted her apology. And she is, when you look at news reports, she is actually really popular among Native American communities across the U.S. because of the way that she talks about sexual assault in Native American communities and other issues that are affecting them. But people are
Actual policy. Shut up, Varka. And we don't do actual policy
now. It's fair to expect that Native American people who I talk to are still hurt by this and they still expect more from her. So I'm waiting for more from her. But the way that the media is covering it is as if it's like, but her emails again. And I'm like, what the fuck else do you have to say? Like, there's nothing else you can possibly ask her about this. She's already apologized. She's already talked about it, about exactly what it is that she believed. And, like, there's no other way you can spin this story other than the fact that she apologized. And so they're still covering it as if it's, like, the breathless scandal of something. Like, it's Watergate. And I'm like, no, it's not. And it's the same thing with Kamala Harris and her weed. And I'm like, I don't understand why you're covering this.
Well, but here's the thing. I will give Jonathan Martin $10 for every Native American person he follows on Twitter. I mean, but like, but that's really what it comes down to is like, yes, these voices are out there and they are saying real things. And the people who have these huge platforms who write for the New York Times aren't fucking listening. And I mean, and so that just really adds to this sort of culture that you know, we just assume that the way that this is being covered by these news outlets is the whole story.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And yeah, go ahead. No, please go ahead.
It's honestly complicated. You know, because this issue in particular has a lot of strands and a lot of moving parts. Like I do think that Elizabeth Warren has been unfairly amplified on this. Mm-hmm. However, you know, I've read a lot of great commentary by Native American activists who point out the specific ways in which they feel like she has not done enough.
Yeah.
And I get what they're saying. I agree with them. I think that she has not handled it in the best way. However, it's been taken by the media and blown out of proportion.
Yeah.
Because it's such a juicy story. And instead of looking at the substance of it and actually talking to Native American activists and getting a coherence, like, here's what she should do, here's what needs to be done, What they do is they just keep uncovering these things, like, you know, the handwritten card that she submitted to the Texas State Bar, mm-hmm. And that only identified herself as Native American. That's a legitimate thing to report if it were done in a context that shows how it's harmful, but they don't do that.
Yeah.
They will point this stuff out and then be like, well, here it is. I'm going to let you figure out all the ways this is problematic.
Right. Well, and again, so that's super problematic, but when they report on other things, they take great pains to point out how it would be problematic. I mean, it's just uneven reporting. And also both things can be true. She can be handling this poorly and it can be blown out of proportion. But I think this kind of segues into the last thing that I really want to talk about, which I think is something that you have a unique and intimate understanding of, which is politics and policy in the age of Twitter. And how, you know, the other day, you know, your life was set on fire because Sarah Sanders announced that Trump was going to declare a national emergency, basically using the Note app on her phone and then putting it on Twitter. And you know, and policy has been legitimately created by Trump on Twitter. Like, you know, like the trans service member ban started as a, what I'm assuming was a 3 a.m. tweet that he made while on the toilet, and it literally became policy. So how, so I don't have a more elegant way to say this except, what the fuck is going on?
You know, it's funny, when I was a kid and I fantasized about being a speechwriter someday, and I did that because, you know, I really wanted to be a speechwriter someday or like a communications professional. And I always thought of it being like, okay, yeah, the hour is going to be, you know, really long and there's going to be a lot of hard work, but it's going to be for issues that I really care about. And in the age of Trump, it feels like every Friday news dump brings some completely unnecessary, vindictive issue that does not need to be out in the public, let alone uttered. And this, for example, is, as you said, this ridiculous national emergency that he's declared to provide funding for his racist border wall. When this hit on Thursday, what you're alluding to is that we were going to do this podcast on Thursday, and I had to cancel it because I had to write up, you know, some of our messaging strategy for our organization to respond to the national emergency. And then the next morning, I thought it was, you know, basically done. Like, we wouldn't hear about this for another week or so. And I was supposed to see Stacey Abrams on Friday morning. I was going to go see her speak at the Brookings Institution and, you know, get to meet her. And I was really excited about it. And then what happens at like 8:30 a.m. Is that we get this announcement that Trump is going to, you know, speak from the Rose Garden and announce his national emergency. And it just completely ruined my day. Like, I have to go back to work, write up this press release for this thing that should not be an issue at all. Like, in no way should a president be declaring a national emergency over this. But, you know, here we are, and this is what life is like. It is a constant day-to-day, you know, house is on fire, you put this fire out, then another house is on fire. And it didn't used to be that way. It used to be that there'd be this one issue, and here's a good analogy for it. Politics used to be this thing where you'd get like this 4 or 5 episode story arc, and you would kind of work through this, you know, one issue over a period of time. Politics now resembles a sitcom in which none of the episodes are really related to each other. There might be running gags, but you have to respond to every single episode that comes up in an isolated way, and it's on a daily basis. You know, someone tweeted yesterday, remember Ralph Northam? Because the national media has essentially moved on from it.
By responding quickly and moving on, also, we lack all of, there's no context or nuance to any of this. And we're not really allowed to look for it. And there's so much going on. So do you think that Twitter has added to this sort of frenzied pace, or has it created a space in which the news, because Twitter is literally 24/7 all over the world, just, you know, cycles through things so quickly? I mean, do you think that do you think Twitter's responding to the politics, or the politics is responding to Twitter?
That's a great question. And I think maybe a bigger question than that is whether or not Twitter has, because essentially what we're asking is, has Twitter been good for American politics?
Yes. I mean, yeah.
Which is a complicated question.
Right.
Because yes, I do hate Twitter on most days.
Sure.
And I look at it more as an obligation in which, you know, there are going to be ridiculous people out on Twitter saying ridiculous things about issues that are important to me. Mm-hmm. They have influence, and therefore I need to be on the front lines talking about those issues too, so that I can provide a counterpoint.
Right.
I mean, that's why I do Twitter, by the way, because otherwise there would be no reason to do Twitter.
Yeah.
Because it's just a garbage site most of the time. However, the ways that Twitter has been great is that it has amplified communities that have not gotten their issues out into the mainstream. So we wouldn't have seen Black Lives Matter and the focus on police brutality without Twitter. We wouldn't have seen, you know, Me Too and, you know, calling into question men who are abusive and predatory without Twitter. We wouldn't have seen, you know, even something like the Arab Spring without Twitter.
Right.
And so Twitter has a way of bringing marginalized communities directly into the national conversation in a way that that access has not been present before.
Right.
And people forget this. They think that Black Lives Matter just appeared because of, you know, CNN covering it or something. And that didn't happen. Right. You know, Black people on Twitter forced American society to reckon with the history of white supremacy in our country and how all white people are complicit in that. And if they hadn't done that, we would not be talking about, you know, Trayvon Martin would have been an obscure trivia question from 6 or 7 years ago without Black people doing activism through Twitter and you know, in social media in general.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it is so complicated. It just, and I wish we could like excise that those parts, like the amplification power of Twitter and the organizational power of Twitter. I mean, you mentioned Arab Spring and the way Twitter was used not just to amplify a message, but to literally plan shit and to get people in the same place at the same time, and kind of excise that from the side where, you know, I'm watching cable news because I hate myself, and and they're literally bringing up tweets from politicians, from Trump, from, you know, there's no, and then the White House is trying to say that Trump's tweets are official White House memos, and
oh, dear God.
Yeah, and I'm just like, I'm like,
yeah,
wait, what? There's no there's no fact checking. There's no, I mean, Twitter is so fast paced, which is the blessing and the curse of it. And so it's like we're supposed to just accept that this is a new medium in which we can report on. And I guess I'm just having a really hard time reconciling that with, you know, being an adult.
So I'm curious real quick, how old are both of you?
I'm 31.
I'm 24.
Okay, so you're my age.
Yeah.
And Marcia, you're not too far behind, but in the late 90s, and Nibon, you can vouch for this, there was this very persistent talking point about the internet. It was that it would bring people together and connect us.
Yeah.
And that it would be the thing that, you know, contributed to world peace and, you know, made culture accessible. And what we've seen instead is that people have used it in really irresponsible and trivial ways. And I'm not talking about fun stuff. Like,
right. You
know, you can have fun online. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the way in which people have used the internet to somehow become lazier.
Right.
Although, which really bothers me. And that's why it's so important for other folks like us to be online, and not just people with platforms, but, you know, everyday folks
right. Who
don't look at this as their part-time job, is to be online and to engage with folks in a way that is informative and illustrative.
Well, because I'm a Pollyanna pants. I mean, the internet did do some of that. It did bring us closer to culture. It did bring us together in a lot of ways. It, you know, sure. Contributing to world peace. Well, no, because there's Twitter. So no, but, it did do some of those really beautiful things, I don't think people comprehended. I don't know that there was a way to comprehend the damage that it could also do.
No. Yeah. It's been interesting. And I'm, look, I don't, I'm certainly not saying the internet is bad. I'm just saying that I feel like we don't talk enough about the ways in which it could be responsible. And there's no standardized set of ethics for it. It's really weird to me that the internet is the most influential thing in society. And yet there's not really much of a push to come together and make a standard set of ethics for it.
Well, I mean, I've seen really insightful political commentary from Twitter handles like cumbucket69. And it's just like, but it's just sort of, and again, I don't necessarily have a problem with that. I mean, my mother-in-law probably does, but like, I don't have a problem with that, but it does sort of speak to this kind of Wild West nature of it, where there aren't ethics. There is no check or balance on it. And so I really wonder if, as we head into this era of people literally making policy on Twitter, and by people I mean Donald Trump on the toilet making policy on Twitter, I mean, is that the future that we want to see, or is there a way to decouple it at all?
Yeah,
we just fucked now. I mean, the answer could be we fucked now. Like,
right. I think that there are politicians who are good examples of how to use Twitter. I mean, Barack Obama is probably, you know, probably the best example for a president. I mean, right. Obviously the only example, but he set a pretty good standard of using Twitter for very formal announcements, and sometimes to engage publicly in a way that was productive and uplifting.
Right. Also to tell everyone how much he loved Michelle Obama, which was always so right. Cute.
And you'll see like members of Congress who maybe use it for that purpose, and also to kind of shape their brand in a way that's, you know, brings their constituents to know them as people, but not in a way to fight with others. I honestly don't believe that members of Congress should be antagonizing people unless it's absolutely necessary on Twitter.
Right.
I would say, like, you know, AOC responding to an unfair attack, that's totally fine. I don't think, for example, that Dan Crenshaw, the Republican congressman from Texas, who is, you know, quite frankly, a dumbass.
who is, I don't know how to put this, ridiculous.
Ridiculous. The way that he tends to be inflammatory and just, he acts like a petulant child on Twitter. That is exactly the wrong way for a member of Congress to use it. And I don't understand why his friends don't send him down and be like, look, you could be so much more influential. You know, even as a Republican, you could win Democrats over to your side if you just weren't such a fucking asshole.
Right.
Online. Let us clowns be, you know, clownish. Like, let us who are in the peanut gallery do that. You're a member of Congress. That's not your job.
Right.
You're supposed to bring people together.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, it's true. And there are a lot of different ways to use it. I mean, like, I love Ted Lieu's Twitter feed because he just spends most of his time trolling people in like a very, but like in a very gentle way. Like, he's not mean about it. There was like a picture of him where he was holding a pad of paper and it said 5,000 pages subpoenaed in response to like the 5,000 troops thing. Just like very gentle trolling. That I appreciate.
He does it in a satirical way that doesn't, you know, certainly draw broad strokes. I mean, he obviously mocks Trump for being ridiculous, and I think that's completely fine.
Right. So, I mean, that kind of thing. I don't know. It just, I have very complicated feelings about Twitter, mainly that I tend to act like a petulant child on Twitter. I'm not a member of Congress, so like I feel like that's completely acceptable.
Shit, so why? I mean, right. Excuse me. I like the most petty fights with people sometimes.
Oh,
I mean,
absolutely.
I'm not running for office.
So my favorite set at Twitter is Brian Schatz from Hawaii, because he knows how people tweet, actually, and he tweets like them, and he talks about policy like them. Like, he'll take a meme that people have been using, and then at the end, he'll just be like, yeah, but Republicans are still holding your healthcare hostage, so, like, it's genius. And it's so good because you know it's actually him tweeting. Like, he says it's him tweeting, it's not his staff. Like, his staff is so pissed at him because they have to like worry that he'll accidentally say something wrong, but he never does. He's really good at it. Same thing with Chris Murphy tweets himself too, but like a lot of others a lot of other senators as well as congressmen and congresspeople don't have the time to do that. But I feel like they should take the time to do that, because the way that Brian Schatz and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and a bunch of other people like Ilhan Omar are able to communicate with the public in a respectful and non-trolly way, as well as make really good jokes and stuff, is really, really inspiring, because you're able to be like, oh, this is exactly what this politician is thinking right now. And now I understand. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think that also adds another layer, though. It's already so hard to be a politician that isn't white and male. And then on top of it, now I have to be as clever as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Yeah. Like, I'm not good at Twitter. Like, and I'm not funny. And so, like, if I were to want to run for office, I now have to have this, like, really complicated and, like, thought-out brand. And I don't know. Again, complicated.
It's really not that hard either. I don't understand. Like, okay, can I point out something real quick? I feel like folks in older generations, not all of them, obviously.
Right.
Some folks in our generations think that there's some kind of key to AOC and the success she's experiencing. They think that she is popular because of some inner, I don't know, youth culture thing. And it's not true. AOC is popular because she speaks authentically about the issues we care about. That's it. That's all there is to it. And you'll notice that the reason Brian Schatz is popular is because he does too. And, you know, the reason that Tammy Duckworth is popular is because she does. And I mean, you know, these folks, maybe they have a social media person who knows how to frame certain tweets or drop certain cultural references. But like Bernie fucking Sanders, who I did not support in 2016, he was popular with a lot of folks precisely because he talked about issues, not because he pandered. No one that we're talking about in terms of, you know, popular Twitter.
And his tweets are boring as hell. Just saying, Bernie Sanders' tweets are boring. So,
right. They're actually very boring, but they're true and they're passionate. And I agree with almost everything that he tweets, right? We should have Medicare for all. We should have free college education. We should do, you know, all these things that contribute to a more, you know, a richer society for all people. But he doesn't pander. I disagree with him on other things and the way he approaches, you know, a certain electoral strategy, but he is very authentic, and that's what people want to see. That's why these folks are popular. And so if you're an elected official listening to this, and you know, who knows who's listening to this, but if you are listening to this, know that Twitter success is due to how you use your authentic voice to communicate your opinions. And that's all there is to it. That's all there is to it.
It's really the beautiful and ugly part of Twitter. Yeah. Well, Charlotte, thank you so much for doing audio brunch with us.
In fact, I might say a sort of podcast called Audio Brunch, honestly.
I was going to say, like, that is amazing. And this was so fun. And I honestly thank you for listening to me tell you what's irritating me lately. And then responding to it.
Absolutely. And I just gotta say, I love Hellbent. I've been following it since the, you know, very beginning when Sarah Lerner was on it. Yes. And I mean, I just love all three of you. You are fantastic.
Thank you.
And so if you're listening to this, don't just listen to this episode. Definitely subscribe to Hellbent Podcast. Follow it in the future, because this is one of those, you know, this is one of those authentic podcasts that are really good.
Right, exactly. Well, thank you so much, Charlotte, and hopefully you can come back on. I would like to do more audio brunch, or just, you know, be smart around me, because I need that. That's why I keep Varsha around. I'm like, you're smart. You can just sit there and be smart. All right. Well, thank you so much. Have a great rest of your day.
Hey, you too. Bye.
Hellbent Podcast is a production of Hellbent Media. It is produced by me, Devin Handy.
And Varsha Venkata Subramanian.
We get editing help from Andrew Walsh. And we, of course, take input from co-creator Sarah Lerner.
You can follow us on social media at Hellbent Pod on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook.
And you can join our Facebook group, Dickwads Be Gone, at facebook.com/groups/dickwadsbegone.
You can follow me on Twitter at @Varsha_Venkat.
And you can follow me at Devin Handy. Also, remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes and rate us 5 stars, because that's just the rules of feminism. Tune in every Monday and Thursday for an intersectional feminist look and the centering of women's voices and people of color. We look at current events, public policy, and upcoming elections to give you the most incisive look into stories that don't get covered elsewhere.